All right. So look, as Duncan just said, I'm coming here not as a crime prevention specialist, but as somebody who is an urban geographer. And my research over the last 10 or 15 years or so, I suppose, has been thinking particularly about conflicts over public space, how those conflicts emerge, and in particular, how we try and deal with them, resolve them, manage them, regulate them, etc. Really, what I wanted to do today was to talk a little bit about crime prevention through environmental design from the perspective of the city, and to ask some questions about what visions of the city underpin or animate different uses of crime prevention through environmental design techniques. That's really where my interest in this stuff lies, and I'm particularly interested to explore the different visions of the city that inform different uses of this really powerful and useful tool. And I suppose, you know, my agenda here is to ask the question about whether some of the ways that crime prevention through environmental design is used are actually, they're being deployed on the benefit of kind of exclusionary visions of the city, it seems to me. And actually, we need to start asking some critical questions about whether we can use this tool in different ways on behalf of more democratic, I would argue, visions of the city. And look, I've taken the title of my paper. I'm sure you're all looking at this piece in recognition because you've all seen the 1984 documentary Star Wars about graffiti in New York City, right? Yes, nobody has. I figured as much. That's okay. But anyway, look, this is a piece that was done by three teenagers from the housing projects of the Bronx in 1980 or so. Scheme, Mean 3 and Dez. And it featured in this documentary, which is now a sort of infamous documentary made right at the height of the sort of battles over graffiti in New York City in the 1980s. It was a three-car piece. There's only surviving pictures of two of the cars. The first car said, "All you see is..." Then we have crime in the city, and then we have the pieces, you know, the tag names of the three people who did it, with a picture of a frustrated police officer down the end of that car. And it seemed to me that, you know, in seeing these three talk about their piece in the documentary, these teenagers are actually articulating a critique of the way the war on graffiti was being waged in New York City at the time, saying that as far as we're concerned, we think we're actually acting out a kind of culture here, but all you see is crime. And you're trying to design it out. And in doing that, these kids felt that they were being designed out of the city themselves. And so that's the kind of tension and dynamic that I want to try and explore a little bit in my talk today. And to ask again, you know, obviously if we're thinking about crime prevention through environmental design, then we need to think about our understandings of crime and how they operate. So it's a presentation in five parts. I want to talk a little bit about how graffiti has emerged as a problem for urban authorities, think about some of the ways that crime prevention through environmental design has been used as an attempt to solve the graffiti problem, following on from some of what Roger was talking about, then to go back and ask a few more critical questions about the problem, the so-called graffiti problem, before thinking about some examples of different approaches to working with graffiti writers to try and reduce fear of crime in certain parts of our city, and using a graffiti as a tool to do that rather than seeing it as a problem that creates fear of crime, and then finally offering a few conclusions based on that sort of analysis. So look, here is a picture, you'll all recognise Tony Blair launching his quality of life and any social behaviour campaign back in the early 2000s by removing some graffiti from a wall in an outer borough of London. Now look, graffiti, as I'm sure all of you know in here, is usually now spoken about as the so-called quality of life offence, right? So to quote Tony Blair from the speech he gave at that site, in isolation he said, "A bit of vandalism here or a bit of graffiti there might seem trivial, but their combined effect can seriously undermine local quality of life. Some criminologists talk of the broken window problem. They argue that a failure to tackle small-scale problems can lead to serious crime and environmental blight. Streets that are dirty and threatening deter people from going out. They signal that the community has lost interest. And as a result, antisocial behaviour and more serious criminality take root." So the argument here is that graffiti sets off a kind of vicious cycle, right? That once graffiti is in a place, it sends a signal to people who perceive that place to be more dangerous, to perceive that place to be not cared for, and so are less inclined to want to be in that space because they feel uncomfortable. And of course, as we know, the fewer people there are in a space, then the more other people will start to feel uncomfortable. And so this sort of vicious cycle kicks off, where a space becomes quite inaccessible and quite fearful for many people. And so crime prevention through environmental design strategies notionally are there to sort of reverse this vicious cycle, to sort of help to eradicate or remove or reduce graffiti in order to stop that vicious cycle from sort of taking root. And so crime prevention through environmental design strategies have been used alongside a whole bunch of other strategies, which include things like, as we've heard, rapid removal, volunteer activities, the formation of specialist graffiti police squads, increased penalties, restriction of the sale of spray paint, markers, chalk, you name it, all those sorts of things have been implemented. But if we talk about crime prevention through environmental design, you know, Rogers has taken you through the key things, so I won't have to go through them in any detail, but obviously some of the key ones that we're familiar with are surveillance and lighting. I'm going to put up a few cheeky little pictures here to talk about the fact that these things are often very effective, but, you know, not always. Sometimes people get around these different strategies. Access control, so all of our bus stops, for example, in order to sort of combat graffiti on that exists on billboards, have put some of these things behind glass. Some people manage to get the key and find ways through those access controls. Green screens, of course, and other surface coatings are used as part of crime prevention through environmental design. This particular haircut hedge was given a haircut by Vincent, who turned it into a nice piece of graffiti as well. And, of course, you know, we put things in like signage. Here's Gladstone Lane in Marrickville, and the sign hasn't quite worked either. So, look, there are some, you know, there are some instances or examples of crime prevention through environmental design approaches. And look, I think it's really important. One of the things that Roger said, and that was the premise of his paper, which is something that I can't stress how much I agree with, is that, you know, the evidence base out here for all of these things, you're right, it is really lacking. Like, we all go out there looking for evidence to support different approaches to dealing with this issue, and there really isn't much of it there. So I think it is really important that we have a good, you know, set up some research programs that actually try and assess, as the New South Wales Department have done, to try and assess the effectiveness of some of these different tools, and have a conversation about whether they work on their own terms as ways of sort of reducing or eliminating graffiti. Now, I guess against those stated objectives, it seems to me that, again, from a qualitative perspective, there are two limitations of some of the SEPTED stuff, it seems to me, over the long term that we need to pay attention to, both of which can be sort of categorised under the broad category of a displacement effect. Firstly, that it seems to me that if you pay attention to graffiti in cities, as I have done for a while, we've seen that as certain hotspots are locked down, then graffiti moves to other spots that haven't been locked down, and we find ourselves in this kind of cat and mouse game of moving hotspots and people trying to track where the graffiti's gone and then trying to close that space down. It reminds me always of those things you see at like Luna Park where the little head pops up and you're there with a hammer trying to bash it down and then another one comes up. So we see this displacement effect geographically, but most importantly, we also see it stylistically, right? Which is that one of the things, for example, about making a spot more difficult or increasing the surveillance is that, you know, you're not going to spend the 4 hours it takes to do a really good piece at a wall where there's a surveillance camera. What you're going to do is scoot through, drop a tag or a sticker and get the hell out of there as quickly as you can. Another example of stylistic displacement is the etchings on glass that Duncan mentioned at the start of today. We never used to see those. And in fact, the etched graffiti originated in New York City on the railway lines once those railway lines had been completely cleansed of paint and ink graffiti, they'd been proofed against it. Some graffiti writers responded by saying, well, if you can remove the paint really quickly and you can remove the ink, it's a bit harder to remove etched glass. And it seems to me that that is a shame because I'm with you. You know, to me, etched tags look like crap compared to some of the other things that we might see in terms of graffiti. So it seems to me that graffiti is getting worse in some ways as a consequence of some of these strategies. And when I say worse, I'm talking about its quality, not just its quantity. So that's some sort of, you know, qualitative evaluation against its stated objectives. But as I said at the start, what I'm really interested in is exploring and critically assessing some of these objectives, as well as just thinking about whether it's successful according to its own criteria. You know, what are the criteria? What's the problem with graffiti? And we need to critically assess how that question is being posed and answered if we're to genuinely assess the effectiveness of crime prevention through environmental design. So I want to return to this argument that graffiti sets up a vicious cycle and that erodes our quality of life in cities. And if we want to unpack some of the assumptions behind that argument, it seems to me that there are three really important questions we need to ask in the case of graffiti. Firstly, there's no such thing as graffiti, right? By which I mean, graffiti, the term we're using here, covers so many different things, it seems to me that we can't just have a one-policy-fits-all approach to dealing with hateful graffiti, political slogans, stickers, stencils, pieces, tags, chalk, etched, posters, etc., etc. There's so many different forms of graffiti now, it seems to me that we ought to have a bit more of a nuanced understanding of some of those differences, partly because, on to my second point, what we are dealing with here is perception, right? And that's, again, where I agree with the septet approach, is that, people's level fear of crime is all about perception. And it seems to me that one of the bits of evidence that we just don't have because nobody's done the research yet is to ask, do people find all forms of graffiti equally troubling? Or is it the case that actually, as with Duncan, I quite like that Banksy stencil, actually. It's just the etched stuff on the back of the buses that really drives me bananas. Now, we're not asking people those questions, and I think we should be, because it may be that actually there are some forms of graffiti that are more tolerable, or in fact people really like, compared to others, and we should develop our strategies accordingly. As I say, largely because we're dealing with perceptions here. It might also be the same when we think about location as well, by the way. One of the questioners, I think, just asked whether there might be a case for saying some parts of our cities should just be left alone, right? So in other words, can we make a distinction between a tag being done on a war memorial and a piece being done in a stormwater canal? Now, I think most people that I seem to talk to in the course of my research can make that distinction. They're less troubled by the piece in the stormwater canal than they are by the tag on the war memorial. So, again, can we think about a geographically sensitive approach to this issue? And finally, it seems to me that, again, because we're dealing with perceptions, we might want to ask some critical questions about where some of these perceptions of graffiti come from that are out there in the community. So one of the arguments, again, that underpins the sort of broken windows vision of the city is this idea that when people see a tag, for instance, it does make them fear. That sends a message of decay and disorder. Now, it seems to me that one of the reasons that people have that perception is because politicians keep telling us that that's what graffiti means, right? So, in other words, there's a sense in which actually broken windows is creating the perception as much as responding to it. This constant recitation of the fact that graffiti signals danger, we don't just read it objectively, we actually come to this thing with preconceptions when we're perceiving it, and of course those preconceptions might actually come from some of that political discourse around graffiti as vandalism, as antisocial behaviour, as a war with the community. So I suppose my worry here is that crime prevention through environmental design is in part turning into a kind of crime prevention through exclusionary design with some of these things, because we're taking those assumptions for granted about the fact that graffiti writers are bad, that all people who are good people out there who take care of their community want it gone completely, and that we're setting up this kind of us versus them approach to the city, which is then feeding into our design efforts. I could spend a whole paper deconstructing this particular poster. Notice how our way of attracting people to Graffiti Action Day is to use a graffiti-style poster. Does my head in. But anyway, there's a sense in which, support your community, join us. This is a strategy that was recycled from New York in the 1970s. Again, it's this kind of, join us, the good people of the community, in our fight against the vandals, stop graffiti attacks. Exclusionary, militarised rhetoric, in a sense, of the war on graffiti, it seems to me, is a problem for us, and it doesn't take account of some of those critical questions that I was trying to ask before. There's a sort of with us or against this thing going on here. And my real worry is that, yes, crime prevention through environmental design does have all sorts of benefits in terms of making people feel like they have a bit more ownership of the space, making people feel a bit safer in some of those spaces, but if it's only doing that by excluding others, then it seems to me that we have a problem, right? In other words, if some people have been made to feel safe at the expense of other people who are being made to feel marginalised and excluded, then we have an issue. So are there any alternatives? And I just want to talk briefly about one place in Sydney that I think offers a kind of alternative, which is a sort of collaborative and curatorial design process that's underway in May Lane, a few kilometres down the way here from us in Sydenham or St Peter's. So look, the story of May Lane is this. There's this little laneway that is the sort of rear entrance for a bunch of residences and light industry on the Princes Highway and May Street, two very busy roads in St Peter's. Now, this lane ought to be dead. Right, it's a classic sort of inner city, you know, light industrial laneway that ought to have, people shouldn't be walking down and hanging out in May Lane. It should be a dead space like most of the other laneways in those parts of cities. But in fact, 8 or 9 years ago now, one of the local business owners on that lane, Tugi Balog, who runs a graphic art shop, noticed that the laneway was typically, you know, attracting different forms of graffiti, some pieces, some tags, some stencils, and he decided that rather than try and figure out ways to stop graffiti in his laneway, he'd actually try and meet some of the artists who were doing it and start inviting them to actually come back during the daytime instead of in the middle of the night and to take their time and to demonstrate the best that they could do. And he started getting the side of his shop painted, and gradually he started actually asking other property owners on the laneway whether they too might actually make their garage doors and their back walls available to graffiti writers and street artists. It's back lanes, it's garage doors, it's not the front of people's property, there's not high stakes involved here. And most of the property owners were actually quite happy to engage in this experiment. And what we see now is the creation of a kind of graffiti commons, I would call it, where people are setting aside their property right, as it were, and making it available for a kind of common cultural expression here. And we see on the side of the Graphic Art Mount building every month or so now, different artists are invited to come and paint the building and some panels. The panels are about now to go on in a tour around Australia for the next 18 months as part of an Australia Council-funded travelling exhibition. And along the rest of the laneway, we see similarly artists, you know, coming and painting people's garage doors and back walls. Now, what seems to me to be interesting and about this particular little experiment in the terms of what we're talking about here today is that this too is a project which is attempting to get out of a vicious cycle and into a sort of virtuous cycle, but it's doing it in a very different way, right? That basically the premise here is that we're kind of curating the laneway. You know, so if you applied the logic of Graffiti Action Day to this, it's the same logic. This notion that what we're doing is mobilising people to come together and care for a space. But they're doing that collaboratively with graffiti writers and street artists and trying to curate the best graffiti. Trying to say, instead of coming through here in the middle of the night and doing your piece in 5 minutes, why don't you come down on Sunday and spend all day? And I'll throw in some paint and put on a barbecue as well, just to make sure you're comfortable. Now, what this does is that it generates, precisely in the way that other CPTED schemes do, it generates this sense of participation and ownership, not just of the property owners, but of nearby residents and also of the graffiti writers. It generates heaps of daytime activity in a laneway that, as I say, ought to be dead, and much to the consternation of the brothel that has its entrance on the laneway, I might add, who's concerned that all this activity is putting off some of their customers who want to be able to enter the premises discreetly. And as we know, more ownership, more activity helps to reduce fear of crime, and the reduction in fear of crime generates more activity. This laneway now, you go and spend a half a day there, there are people coming from all over Sydney, from interstate and indeed even from international places to look at the art in this lane. Residents use this now as a back way through to St Peter's train station in a way that they just weren't doing 10 years ago because there's always people around and they feel comfortable there. So graffiti, in a sense here, is being mobilised as a design tool to make places better, to reduce fear of crime. Now look, clearly here, these residents, the property owners and others, are actually putting up with a little bit of disorder and a little bit of chaos in making this graffiti commons happen. So I've just shown you some beautiful pictures of some of the great artwork that goes on. On the left, you know, is a garage door as it looks right a week ago, and I'll pop down there again. You know, there's a lot of colour and a lot of craziness going on down in this laneway. There's paint drips everywhere, there's stickers all over the place. But again, we're talking about a laneway in a semi-industrial area, and actually, so what? right? Now, the people that are doing this aren't about to mug you. They're not going to try and sell you drugs. They're just dropping by, looking at the really good pieces and leaving their name to say respect. Now, not everybody participates. There are a couple of property owners who don't want to know about this and who are trying to keep their properties clean. And that's fair enough, of course. Not everybody has to like this. But what's really interesting to me in that context is that there's a sense in which here the occasional blank space actually reminds us that we disagree about how our city should look. But here, what we're seeing is that some people's perspective isn't being imposed completely on everybody else's in the kind of zero-tolerance approach, but we're actually getting a visual cue about the differences that we have with each other about how our city should feel and look. So look, in terms of my concluding comments, and I have two sort of comments to try and take away. I guess it seems to me that this WA leaflet that they put out as part of their current graffiti strategy sums up what I think are our current approaches, which is that either we have a trashed lane with, you know, look, bad weather, graffiti and a bombed out car, or we have a really nice lane with good weather and no graffiti. And it seems to me that I'm trying to say that these aren't our only two options if we're thinking about trying to make our cities more livable. I'm trying to say that there are different options that we have in between these two, and frankly, I wouldn't like to live in either of those two places if that's what the WA government is asking me. So that's my sort of comment about graffiti. But more generally, I suppose I'm coming back to this, you know, in terms of SEPTED more generally, coming back to this issue about the vision of the city that animates our design efforts. So I'm not making a case against crime prevention through environmental design per se. What I'm doing is trying to make a case that it should be mobilised on behalf of collaborative and democratic visions of the city rather than sort of exclusionary visions of the city which set up this kind of us versus them sort of context. How can we use the design process more to engage with one another across our differences? Sometimes we won't resolve the differences, but that's what living in a city is all about, and we have to come to accommodations. So I think that's where I probably want to leave it. I've got a copy of a paper here that has the long version of this talk if anybody's interested to read it, but thanks very much for listening.